Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. They were just kids. The youngest, age 8, the oldest, 15. The four youngest had been born free. The eldest had seized his own freedom, running away from his master in New Jersey. One day, in August 1825, they were independently walking the streets of Philadelphia. The next day, they were kidnapped and thrust into slavery. What happened to them? Why is it significant for all of us? We learn their story in a gripping new book titled Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. Its author, its detective in a way, is Richard Bell, who teaches early American history at the University of Maryland College Park. Professor Bell is here in the studio to share the astonishing odyssey. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you so much for having me.
How were these five boys kidnapped?
They were kidnapped on the streets of Philadelphia in August 1825 by a gang that specialized in this, that had done it before and that would do it again. And the ruse was a simple one. A stranger would come up to a child on the street who looked like he was looking for work, who looked like he might be hungry and could use enough money, maybe 25 cents, to buy some buns for breakfast. And the stranger would offer this free black child 25 cents if he would walk this way and come down to a ship just outside the center of Philadelphia and help the stranger unload peaches or watermelons, supposedly in a cargo hold there. The boy would walk on deck, go down below deck looking for the peaches and crates of watermelons he was supposed to help unload. And then the stranger's mask would drop away, and it became very quickly clear that these boys had been lured into a place of great danger. They would be tied up in the holds of these small ships, sometimes until these ships were bursting to capacity, and then these ships would sail away.
When I first learned about your book, I was interested because I figured the situation in early 19th century Philadelphia, home to so many free blacks, would parallel conditions in Baltimore, also home to free blacks. But I didn't know so much of this story that starts in Philadelphia unfolds in Maryland. Tell us what happened.
That's right, yes. This story that I'm telling in the book, Stolen, focuses on a particular kidnapping case, the five free boys you mentioned who were kidnapped by this fearsome gang of kidnappers and human traffickers who are actually based on the eastern shore of Maryland, close to the Delaware state line. And this gang of kidnappers and human traffickers have been active there since the early 1800s. By the mid-1820s, when this story takes place, they've become highly skilled, highly professionalized, very fiendishly good at the grotesque trade they do for a living. And they typically warehouse the children they kidnap out of cities like Baltimore and Philadelphia on the eastern shore in a pair of, let's call them, safe houses that they own and operate on that boundary line near Maryland and Delaware. And if they can't find a semi-lawful legal interstate slave trader to buy them from them, they will typically take them across the Chesapeake Bay and then march these kidnapped free black children halfway across the continent, down as far as Mississippi, Alabama, or Louisiana, in hopes of selling them as slaves to planters setting up their raising sugar or cotton, some of whom are quite hard up and are looking for a great deal on enslaved labor, which is what these kidnappers provide.
And so this group assembled by these kidnappers, tell us, just tick off who it was.
So five boys, I'm just going to use their first names, Cornelius, Joe, Sam, Enos, and Alex. The youngest of these boys, as you mentioned, is 8 years old. The oldest
That's Alex.
Is, yes, that's right. And the oldest is 15. His name is Sam. Cornelius is the only one among them who can read or write. He's 10 years old. He's done a couple of years of schooling in Philadelphia. Four of these boys were born in freedom in Philadelphia to lawfully free black parents. The two of the boys are chimney sweeps. The fifth boy, Sam, who's 15, is, as you mentioned, a runaway from plantation slavery. And your listeners might be thinking that he might be running away from slavery in Maryland or Delaware or Virginia or somewhere further south, but he's actually running away from his master on a plantation in New Jersey, which is to the north and east of Philadelphia. New Jersey, it turns out, is the last remaining northern slave state in this period. So Sam sees Philadelphia and the chance to run south towards Philadelphia as his best shot at Freedom. He hopes to fit in with that large and dynamic free black community in Philadelphia, similar to the one in Baltimore. And he spends his first 7 days in Philadelphia as a runaway from slavery, living on the streets and looking for odd jobs and work. And then a stranger comes up to him and says, I've got 25 cents for you if you come do this job for me.
Before the kidnappers take this group south, they add two women, one enslaved, one free.
That's absolutely right, yes. So my book focuses on the experience of five of the boys in this particular coffle, is the word they use, these walking chain gangs who march halfway across the country. But in this coffle, there are two adult women as well. The names are Mary Fisher and Mary Neal. And one has also been kidnapped by very similar means, by the same kidnappers, which is why she's there alongside these five boys. And the other woman, whose name is also Mary, is someone who was born into slavery, who's been legally purchased by this kidnapper, by these kidnappers, and she marches alongside the other six people across the country. And as best we can tell, the reason that she is there is because she has the right sort of papers, which can be quickly copied to create forged documents, so it can look like the other six kidnapped victims of human trafficking are also legally trafficked as well.
That's Richard Bell, scholar and associate professor of early American history at the University of Maryland College Park. I'm Sheila Cass. This is On the Record on WIPR. We're talking about his book, Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. You call this crime scheme the reverse Underground Railroad. Unpack that.
Yes, listeners are very familiar, I hope, with the Underground Railroad. The reverse Underground Railroad is its evil opposite, which is to say, if the Underground Railroad is about enslaved people seeking freedom with assistance from brave conductors and station agents like Harriet Tubman, and often going from the south to the north, then this reverse Underground Railroad is the forced migration of free people via kidnapping and human trafficking into southern slavery, typically moving from the north to the south. The numbers were huge over the course of the first 50 years of the 19th century. We might be talking in the thousands, if not tens of thousands, of free people kidnapped onto this reverse Underground Railroad. And that sort of magnitude of kidnapping and human trafficking turns out to be roughly the same size as the number of people who escaped slavery on Harriet Tubman's Underground Railroad in the course of 50 years as well.
Until your book, the most famous example in the 21st century of this kind of kidnapping was Solomon Northup, the movie 12 Years a Slave, based on his memoir. Why have we focused so much more on the Underground Railroad than the reverse Underground Railroad?
So Solomon Northup's story is one of the rare insider accounts we have of what the reverse Underground Railroad was like from the perspective and experience of a free black person who was kidnapped into it. We know vastly more about the Underground Railroad because a good number of people who exited slavery on it wrote about their experience afterward. Some of the conductors and station agents later wrote memoirs about their work, folks like William Still and Thomas Garrett. Harriet Tubman herself went on speaking tours about the work, went on fundraising tours, right? We know far less about the reverse Underground Railroad because the kidnappers and human traffickers did not leave memoirs. They didn't leave bundles of business records in historical societies for historians like me to stumble upon. They didn't pose for photographs. So it's only thanks to memoirs like Northup, which are very few in number, that we're able to learn much at all inside that black box of human misery that was the reverse Underground Railroad.
Let's pick up the story of the five boys whom you focus on. They're taken by boat to New Orleans?
No, not quite. They are taken by boat, as you say, from Philadelphia. That little boat makes its way to the Delmarva Peninsula, to this borderline town close to the Delaware and eastern shore of Maryland state line, where this gang has a pair of safe houses that they own. After a week spent in captivity there, the boys are then put onto a smaller boat which crosses the Chesapeake Bay and dumps them out at Norfolk, Virginia. And then over the next 4 months, these five boys and these two adult black women, along with the two captors who are members of this larger gang, their two captors marched them, mostly on foot, across several states in the course of 4 months in the hopes of selling them to planters in Mississippi or Alabama. And that journey is a monstrous distance. We estimate it's a journey of about 2 million steps.
And they're barefoot, the
boys. They're barefoot most of the time, that's right.
To compress a lot that you're able to report from the incredible research you did, along the way, Cornelius, the 10-year-old who can read and write, is sold for $300, not as much as his kidnappers had hoped.
That's right. Kidnappers often had to discount heavily the sale price of the kidnapped free people, often children, they were trying to sell to planters in Alabama, Mississippi, and elsewhere, because it was painfully evident to everyone in any attempted slave sale in the Cotton Kingdom that the person being sold was sometimes legally free, because those children would speak up and say, "Please don't buy me. I am legally free. I've been kidnapped. Please help me get home. Please help me find my family." And typically speaking, to stifle the pangs of conscience of potential buyers, kidnappers would start dropping the price until they could reach a deal with a cotton planter who was hard up, not super wealthy, needed to expand the size of his enslaved labor force, and was willing to buy someone he knew probably to be lawfully free if the price being offered was right. Now, in the book I've written, Stolen, there's a version of that interaction which ends in the sale of Cornelius Sinclair for $300, as you said, less than the kidnappers had hoped. And there's another interaction with another potential buyer in a different state involving the four other boys, which does not go as planned, which goes, from the kidnapper's perspective, dramatically off the rails when the boys speak up loudly and clearly about who they are, where they're from. And I'm not going to say too much about what happens next, but it's those boys speaking loudly and clearly about who they are, where they're from, that they're free, that changes the course of this particular story, so it doesn't end in the way that so many other stories of the reverse Underground Railroad do, which is in endless labor on southern plantations and children and adults from free towns and cities who are never heard from again.
We need to take a short pause in our conversation with historian Richard Bell. Tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road, he'll be taking questions about his new book, Stolen: Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. I'm Sheila Cast. After a short break, who helped these stolen boys? Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. The new book by University of Maryland historian Richard Bell reads like a mystery, but it's carefully researched and documented. It's titled Stolen: Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. The astonishing journey you chronicle involves more people playing different roles than we can recount right now. The players included a Southern lawyer, a slaveholder, and the activist mayor of Philadelphia, Joseph Watson, a Quaker. Is there a way to give us a brief idea what happened?
As you said, there's a large cast of characters in the second half of the book who work together, sometimes to everyone's benefit, sometimes serving their own personal and political interests, who are able to offer the boys a path to achieve what they want most of all, which is to get home. And while I could talk about why a couple of Southern slaveholders behave in ways totally unexpected from what many of our listeners might think they would do in a situation like this, and while I could talk about the mayor of Philadelphia and his own personal motivations, I'd actually just highlight two other groups who are instrumental in the happy ending that ends this particular story. One is the boys themselves, of course, who sound the alarm at every turn, who blow the whistle, who do everything they can to run away from their captors at different points in this story, to resist. And another is the boys' parents. Four of the boys have families living in Philadelphia. The fifth is a runaway from slavery in New Jersey, you'll recall. And the boys' parents seem to work tirelessly to exert tremendous political pressure, lobbying, I guess would be the modern word, lobbying the mayor of Philadelphia, lobbying what passes for law enforcement in Philadelphia and the state of Pennsylvania to make sure that any promises made to them are actually kept and executed. And if one reads the surviving records of Philadelphia's anti-slavery group at this time, the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, we can find that their officers were consistently lobbied by free black parents like these every time a free black child went missing in Philadelphia. You imagine a Quaker lawyer, a Quaker merchant sitting down to Sunday dinner with his family. He's also a member of the anti-slavery group. And seemingly every week, there will be a knock at the door. He'll go to the front door, and there will be a free black person in tears and furious and say, "My child, my son, my daughter has gone missing. We suspect someone has taken them and spirited them away. Please try and help." And sometimes that help is useful and successful.
Part of what you know, much of what you know about this case comes from depositions that Mayor Watson took from the five boys after they got back to Philadelphia.
Yes, it's true. Not all of the boys do make it back to Philadelphia of the original five, four of them eventually do. And one of their great acts of political activism, not only to save themselves, is to give as much information as they can to this arguably crusading mayor of Philadelphia. He's not in office for very long. People vote him out. But in the 4 years he's in office, he takes a strong interest in the protection of black children. He gathers testimony from these surviving boys who are very happy to give it to him. And it's amazing how much they can recall, how much they're willing to say about their experience. They can name names. They've got dates. And the mayor uses this testimony to launch the largest manhunt, I think, in the nation by the 1820s to try to round up and apprehend as many of the members of this large kidnapping gang as he can. And that effort has mixed results, but there are multiple convictions at the end of this particular story.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with University of Maryland Associate Professor Richard Bell about his book Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. So, was justice served?
It's very rare that free African-American people who seek justice achieve it in the early 19th century America, whether we're in Baltimore, Philadelphia, or Mississippi. What we can say is that several of the members of the gang were apprehended after unusual efforts by the mayor of Philadelphia to round up these kidnappers. Two of them ended up serving significant prison sentences. In fact, one of the most surprising finds I came across in the course of doing research for this book were two handwritten letters from one of the kidnappers serving effectively a life sentence a few years later for this work, writing to the governor of Pennsylvania begging for leniency, that the sentence he believed was too harsh, and trying to throw himself on the mercy of the governor for a lighter sentence. I'm pleased to report that was unsuccessful and that he served much of his term. But that discovery, to find even a fragment in the handwriting of one of these monsters, was a major turning point in the research for this book.
Was their case well known at the time?
Their case was well known at the time. And also, to be clear, Sheila, the larger phenomenon that so many black people, adults and children, were being kidnapped and going missing from the streets of cities and towns like Philadelphia was also extremely well known. How people responded to that knowledge varied a lot. It varied by class, it varied by race, it varied by geography. And we shouldn't assume for a hot second that the white population of Philadelphia was united in its disgust about the kidnapping of free black people in this period. But yes, this particular case got a good degree of coverage after as it was happening. And that coverage was such that the state of Pennsylvania, within a year, passed a tough new anti-kidnapping measure called a personal liberty law designed to protect the liberty of free black people within the boundaries of the state of Pennsylvania. And as you may know, that causes a series of retaliations by Southern slaveholders who see these sorts of personal liberty laws as an affront to their rights as property owners in people. And those retaliations culminate in a Supreme Court case in 1842 called Prigg versus Pennsylvania, which features Roger Tawney of Maryland in a prominent role, and later culminates in the passage of something that most American high schoolers have studied, which is the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, a pro-slavery abomination that puts the United States on a course, collision course, really, with civil war within a decade.
One powerful aspect of your book is that it forces us to think why kidnapping free African Americans did or should evoke a different outrage than asserting ownership over black people, the legal slavery. You write about how anti-slavery activists started to use the same language for both of these situations.
That's right. So this true story takes place in 1825, and the American anti-slavery movement at that time is pretty modest, pretty marginal, and tends to focus on lawyerly approaches to individual freedom suits, for instance. But within 10 years, the American anti-slavery movement has started to grow and change, and it started to embrace print and, let's call it, anti-slavery propaganda, trying to reach new audiences, to get white northern evangelical households who are not engaged in the anti-slavery fight to step up and care about the plight of southern slaves generally. One of the things I discovered in the course of working on this story of these five boys and what happened to them is that in its aftermath, we see more and more anti-slavery writers not just beat the drum about the kidnapping of free black people into slavery, which they do and loudly, but also start to tar Southern slavery as an institution as being nothing more than man-stealing, nothing more than kidnapping, right? So that slavery itself is being prosecuted in the court of public opinion is something that is criminal, that is illegal, that is immoral, that is unchristian, that is unconstitutional. And the word and concept of kidnapping to describe the unfortunately lawful buying and selling of American slaves becomes a way to smear Southern slavery in the court of public opinion, which proves, thank goodness, to be relatively effective in advancing the cause of anti-slavery in this country.
Thank you for this book.
Thanks, Sheila. I appreciate it.
Richard Bell's new book is Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. Richard Bell will be speaking about the book tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop, 6080 Falls Road in Baltimore. On Saturday afternoon, 1 p.m., he'll be at Politics and Prose on Connecticut Avenue Northwest in Washington. And on Sunday afternoon, he'll be in Frederick at the C. Burr Arts Public Library, 110 East Patrick Street. That event, co-hosted by the Curious Iguana Bookstore, starts at 2 p.m. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, we've got links to information about the book and several events. On the Record's director and engineer is Nathan Sterner. Maureen Harvey and Melissa Gear produced the program. John Ahrens wrote and recorded the On the Record theme music. Jamila Kremple is WYPR's digital producer. I'm your host, Sheila Cast. Thanks for spending part of Veterans Day with us. We salute all who have served to protect and defend our country.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.